Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song. I wrote him back a letter, and I told him it was not the perfect country and western song because he hadn't said anything at all about mama or trains or trucks or prison or getting drunk. Well, he sat down and wrote another verse to the song, and he sent it to me, and after reading it, I realized that my friend had written the perfect country and western song, and I felt obliged to include it on this album. The last verse goes like this here. Well, I was drunk the day my mom got out of prison, and I went to pick her up in the rain. But before I could get to the station in the pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train.
And there you have kind of the quintessential country song there, one verse of it in that collaboration between Steve Goodman and John Prine, and David Allen Coe made it famous. You never even called me by my name. Well, it's gone by various names over the years, ever since the early days of recording and radio. One of the most listened to music formats has been what we now call country, but where did that sound come from and how has it evolved over the years? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. With me is one of America's foremost authorities on country music, Bill Malone, the author of The Definitive History of Country Music, Country Music USA, first published in 1968 and republished in a 50th anniversary edition in 2018. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, we've called it back in the day country western, and before that, I guess it was even called hillbilly music, and now we call it country. So how do we sort this all out? How far back do we go?
Well, the term hillbilly is what I grew up with, and there are still people in the country music industry today like Marty Stewart and Dwight Yoakam who will still refer to it as hillbilly. I mean, I think that's a reaction against the attempt to just take any identity away from country music and just make it something sophisticated modern people hear. And so people who use hillbilly are still proud of its past, still proud of the fact that the music grew out of blue-collar origins. When the music itself, in one sense, is as old as America. You know, people usually at home or in community settings played fiddle tunes, or they formed string bands, they sang ballads, they would sometimes do step dancing, sing gospel songs. But it wasn't organized in any way, and there was no way for it to reach a larger audience outside of communities unless some professional singer would adopt a ballad or a fiddle and make it part of his or her repertoire and introduce it to an audience, usually through vaudeville. But the music itself didn't begin to take shape as a commercial commodity until the 1920s, because that, for the first time, musicians had the opportunity to extend the popularity of their music far beyond their communities through radio broadcasts and phonograph recordings. So that marked the beginning of what we now call country music. And you're right, people didn't know what to call it. But the Columbia record label referred to the old-time songs in their roster as old familiar tunes. And I think that's a good description, because what these early musicians were doing were just performing, sometimes in their entirety, but more often than not, as fragments, old songs and tunes they'd grown up with. And those songs and tunes could have come from vaudeville, they might have come from Tin Pan Alley, as many of them did, or they might have been material that came over on the boats from Europe. It was just a hodgepodge of musical forms that had been developing, but were now given sort of a firm foundation through these new commercial forces.
If we go back to these earliest days of recording this music that we're going to call country, are there recordings that actually sort of hark back to the earlier times, or were they all pretty much the contemporary sound when they hit the airwaves?
Well, a lot of the early groups that performed on radio and recording were string bands. String bands in just every state, and they could usually be identified by their regional origins. And it wasn't until radio and recording came along that they began to learn from each other, and their local identities began to fade away. But on the other hand, there was something they all had in common. The music had been performed usually at home. People would just take the furniture out of a room, bring in a fiddler. And that's usually all they had was just one fiddler. And they would play all night as people danced. The dances that might come at the end of a harvest period might be a celebration of a house raising, or it might be a Christmas celebration. And a song like A Soldier's Joy, an old 18th century tune, gives a good flavor of how this early music sounded. And it also gives a little idea of the context in which the music was played.
Well, folks, here we are again, the Skillet Lickers, red hot and raring to go. We're going to play you another little tune this morning. Want you to grab that gal and shake her foot and moan. Don't you let them dance on your new carpet. You make them roll it up.
In the bread tray, scratching that dog, brandy when your dog bites low, child. Play in the center and just get your hair holding you, don't let it rest.
Well, it's easy to think that that came pretty much directly from England, Ireland, Scotland into the Appalachians and into that recording.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I think we tend to probably overemphasize the Appalachians. It's always had such a romantic connotation for us. But in fact, that could have been of African-American origin in some respects. We don't know what the style was when it first came overseas. We know that Americans put their own stamp on it.
Seems that you have a fair number of family acts in these early days of recording. I mean, and maybe even you could call them dynasties in the case of the Carter family.
Yeah, the Carter family is a really interesting example of a family continuity. You know, Maybelle Carter had a daughter, June, who married Johnny Cash. And then Johnny Cash had children that made and still make music. And so it's a tradition that's existed from the 1920s right on up to the present. The Carter family is probably the best example of the family acts that you mentioned. It was a trio. A fellow named A.P. Carter, who played fiddle a little bit, but not too much, but he was more of a song collector than anything else. He and his wife, Sarah, who played the auto harp, and their sister-in-law, Maybelle, who was only 17 years old when they made their first recordings, but she introduced a guitar style of playing the melody with the thumb on the bass strings and keeping the rhythm going with her fingers. She played other instruments too and other styles, but that was her main one. And for a long, long time, fledgling musicians, you know, tried to learn her style. And invariably, the song they would practice on was the one that they made a hit of in about, I think, around 1928 or so. It was a song that they called Wildwood Flower, but it could trace its origin back to a 19th century tune called I'll Twine Mid the Ringlets. And if I remember correctly, I don't know, I can't recall the author's name, but there was a Wisconsin person who had a hand in making that original song. But Wildwood Flower was played so often that people often jokingly refer to it as the national anthem of hillbilly music.
Oh, I'll twine with my mangle pale and the leader and eyes look like blue.
You get a good idea from that of the singing style of the Carter family and also that guitar style. And it also kind of, the singing style makes me think, Bill, of the Yodeling Brakemen.
Well, they're similar in that they're sort of untrained voices reflecting plain folk or working class existence. But by one of those wonderful accidents of history, they were recorded at the same time. There was a fellow named Ralph Peer, what we now call the A&R man, who first worked for OK Records and then by 1927 was working for the Victor Talking Machine Company. He came south looking for musicians to record. He was actually looking for blues musicians, but he began to find out there were all kinds of fiddlers and string bands, gospel singers who could record too. So he set up his equipment, he and his engineers. They just found an available building in Bristol, Tennessee, just right where the line breaks through the city, Virginia on one side, Tennessee on the other. And at the first few days, the first 4 days of August 1927, a variety of acts came to him. And one act was the Carter family coming down from Macy Spring, Virginia. The other act was this tubercular ex-railroad worker from Meridian, Mississippi, who'd been living and playing music up in not Knoxville. I forget exactly. I ought to know that. I mean, anyway, he came down to Bristol, too, and he recorded his first two songs. And they showed enough promise that some months later, Peer invited Rogers to come to Camden, New Jersey.
Jimmy Rogers.
That was the central headquarters for Victor at that time. And at this next session, Rogers recorded the first of his so-called blue yodels. There were at least 12 of them. The various blues fragments, and at the end of each stanza, he would usually yodel in some way. And it was one of those of which we now call Tea for Texas, which was his most popular song. People still sing that today. You can go anywhere and start singing it, and people will recognize it. But he was an ex-railroad worker, and so he carried the romance of the rails with him, this image of the guy who had been everywhere and done everything. And so I think that contributed to his popularity. But he did a song called Waiting for a Train, which was probably his most popular, most enduring song. And I think when you listen to it, you hear a lot of the influences that went into the making of country music. You hear a Hawaiian steel guitar. You hear a little jazz band. And you hear his famous yodel, and you also, of course, hear the romance of the railroad being spelled out in song. And of course, railroad songs have been popular ever since. But this, a lot of people know this by its first line, "All Around the Water Tank," but its official name was "Waiting for a Train."
Jimmy Rogers.
Not a penny can I
ratio. Get off, you railroad bum. He slammed the boxcar door. Ole-ee, ee, ole-ee.
It's all in there, isn't it, Bill? You got that 20s kind of prohibition jazz sound, and then, as you mentioned, the Hawaiian steel guitar, and then the yodel, all these things kind of in a big stew that you never would have thought of putting together, but Jimmy Rogers makes it work.
Yeah, well, the musicians were experimenting. This is a brand new musical genre as far as commercialism is concerned, and so they were taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that, trying to find out what would work.
Well, speaking of such things, by the time we get into the big band era, we'll say from 1935 till 1945 or so, you find that sound too, don't you, in country music?
Yeah, country musicians have always been experimental. We fans, you know, sometimes don't want them to be. You know, we hear them do a particular song, a particular style. We want to keep it that way forever. But the musicians are like musicians everywhere. They listen to whatever's around, and they incorporate it into their music. And all over the country, the South and the Midwest particularly, musicians had been experimenting with jazz forms since the 1920s. Jimmy Rogers, as we've heard, was a good example. But the music really began to take on a particular shape out in the western part of the South in Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, when musicians like Milton Brown in Fort Worth, Bob Wills in Central Texas and later West Texas, they began to form string bands that could play old-time tunes. They could do old-time hoedowns, but they also did pop, blues, and jazz. And we now call that music Western Swing. They didn't call it that then. It was just music. And a lot of critics and publicists, when they heard it, they would refer to it sometimes as hot fiddle music or something like that. But it wasn't until the 1940s, particularly out on the West Coast, when Spade Cooley was attracting thousands of listeners with his experiments. He was the first person to call his music Western Swing. But its roots lie back in the 1930s with music of people like Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. And one particular song in 1936, there's one called the Steel Guitar Rag, which not only shows this fusion of traditional string band music with more modern styles, it also indicates the direction that country music is going to go. It's going to follow electrification, and it's and the steel guitar becomes central to this experimental electric phase.
Look out, friends! Here's Leon. Take it away, boys. Take it away. Oh, everybody dance now.
Aptly called the Steel Guitar Rag, one of the best-known pieces of Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys from 1936. And we'll get further into the history of country music when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Bill Malone, and we're looking into the history of what we now call country music. It had various other names and styles along the way. But by the time we get into the 1930s and the end of Prohibition, people went going back and playing in bars, you know, without fear of being busted. How does that affect country music?
Well, country music found a new audience, for one thing. It didn't have to depend on the radio audience or schoolhouses where a lot of people played back before they had electric amplification, all kind of community enterprises like that. But musicians more and more began to go into these bars and taverns. And eventually, the music they created there became known as the honky-tonk style. But like so many terms, it wasn't used at the time. The music had to develop and had to have fans who would, you know, want to give some sort of label to it. But it was, as you said, the repeal of Prohibition, but also the gradual maturation of electric instruments and the realization that in the honky-tonks, you had an audience that didn't necessarily come to listen to the singing. They came to hear the music and to dance to it. So they wanted music with a strong beat and feel to it. And it was during World War II that the changes that began to occur in the 30s began to take real shape, and the honky-tonk style really matured during those years. But one of the pioneers of honky-tonk style was a fellow named Ernest Tubb out of Texas. He actually owned a honky-tonk for a while and played in all the bars and honky-tonks he could find in Texas. Started out as a Jimmy Rogers imitator, but when he finally found out that he couldn't yodel, and his reason being that he had a tonsillitis and that took away his ability to yodel, he developed his own style, which was just about as widely admired and imitated as Rogers was. But nevertheless, Ernest Tubb becomes a good example of the way that music is changing during those years and in which the honky-tonk style is beginning to take shape.
And this is
Walking the Floor Over You is his big one.
And you went away. You said that you'd be back in just a day. You've broken your promise and you've left me here alone. I don't know why you did, dear, but I do know that you're gone. I'm walking the floor over you. I can't sleep a wink, that is true. I'm hoping and I'm praying as my heart breaks right in two. Walking the floor over you. Oh, pick it out, Smitty.
Well, by the time we get to Ernest Tubb, we seem to be tapping into some of those themes that we started this conversation with that are such bulwarks of country music today. You know, splitting up and kind of the whole...
And the fear of splitting up.
And the fear of splitting up and the downside of life, you might say.
And but as country music has always been marked by both change and innovation, while there have always been the pioneers who created new sounds and styles and attracting new audiences, there are always those who really harken back to the past, who embraced any kind of sound that seemed traditional or reflective of the music's original working-class roots. While the honky-tonk people and the Western swing people were evolving during those years, there were still a lot of musicians who clung to the older styles, particularly what we sometimes refer to as the brother duets, the Monroe brothers and the Callahan brothers and the Shelton brothers and the Bolick brothers, on and on and on, Delmore brothers. And I think the brother duets tended to perform with only a minimum of instruments, and with the mandolin often being the lead instrument. And they generally tended to do gospel songs or old-time heart songs and that sort of thing. The Leuven brothers don't date back quite that far. They date back to the late 1940s, early 50s. But a lot of people think that Ira and Charlie Leuven from Henniger, Alabama, it represented the best of the duet tradition. And I think a song that really represents their style, plus that some of these old sounds that people are so fond of, was a song that's been recorded in many, many ways by many people called In the Pines.
In the pines, in the pines, where the sun never shines, and you shiver when the cold wind blows. Little girl, little girl, what have I done that's made you treat me so? You've caused me to weep, you've caused me to moan, you've caused me to leave my home. In the pines where the sun never shines, and you shiver when the cold wind blows.
Well, we're hearing those close harmonies, as we will hear later with another set of brothers, the Everly Brothers. But also there's something here, and of course the same themes that you mentioned, Bill, having to do with, you know, breaking up and all of that. But also there's this nasal quality to the vocals, which I didn't notice so much earlier, but is that kind of an ongoing theme in country music?
I guess you can always point to certain musicians who had that sound, but I think probably just as many who didn't. I don't know. It'd be kind of hard to, but you're certainly right. Jimmy Rogers had it. Charlie Poole, another one of the very early influential performers, definitely had it. But his hero was Al Jolson. That's where he got his nasal
sound.
Wow,
what an interesting. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought of that combination.
But that's kind of a hard head sound, and you know that, I don't know, somehow just is appealing.
Well, it certainly has appealed to a lot of people for a long time. One of the real bulwarks of country music is Bill Monroe. And what did he bring to the medium?
He started out in one of these brother duets, one of the most famous. That was the duet he formed with his brother Charlie, of course, the Monroe brothers. Their heyday was from 1934 to 1936.
A short heyday.
Yeah. And then they broke up, literally. They I think they had a fist fight. A lot of these duets could make close to vocal harmony, but they didn't get along with each other.
I think there's some gunshots involving at least one of the wives in there, too.
Yeah. And Bill Monroe always loved the old-time songs, gospel music. He was strongly influenced by Pentecostal music and groups that he heard. But his hero was Jimmy Rogers, but he updated the Jimmy Rogers sound. It really, really put it on steroids. And he created a sound which was widely popular. He called his band the Bluegrass Boys. So little by little, as people began to imitate what he was doing, people began to refer to the bluegrass sound. We don't know exactly when the term really came into full use, probably sometime in the early 1950s. But it was Bill Monroe and his band that created the style and evoked the popularity. And in a song like It's Mighty Dark to Travel, we hear all the basic ingredients of the bluegrass sound. We hear the high lonesome singing, the duet style. We hear sort of a jazz-style mandolin chords, bluesy fiddle, and above all, the syncopated three-finger banjo style of Earl Scruggs, the person who really gave the sound its vitality.
It's mighty dark for me to travel, for my sweetheart she is gone. Though his love been filled with travel, but I must get me on and on.
Oh, it's mighty dark to travel.
To me she was a little angel, down to me from God above. Was on the day that I first met her that I told her of her love.
It's mighty dark for me to travel, for my sweetheart she has gone.
Though she's rough and filled with gravel, but I must journey on and on.
You can see where that rapid-fire banjo playing would capture people's imaginations, whether they got to see it live or just heard it on the radio. But by the time we get into the very early 50s now and the genesis of rock and roll, what kind of crossovers are between those early rock stars and country music?
Rock and roll as such has not yet emerged in the early 50s, but its antecedents are there. And in the South, where the musicians who experimented with the new forms of music came to be known as rockabillies, because they were sort of combining the rocking sound of black music with the traditional sounds that they grew up with. All these young musicians grew up listening to country music. A lot of them, you know, would say that Bill Monroe, for example, was one of their favorites because he had such vitality, such energy. And it was out of that fusion of interest that they began to create their own forms of music. And it was in 1954 that Elvis, you know, made his name known. But before he came along, though, Hank Williams was dominating the country charts. And he had a few songs that rocked, like Hey Good Looking, for
sure.
Example.
Yeah.
But Hank was eclectic. He borrowed sounds and styles from all kinds of folks, and he thought of himself as being traditional country. A little bit of Jimmy Rodgers, a little bit of Ernest Tubb, a little bit of Roy Acuff, until he came up with his own style. But one thing that set Hank apart from all these other people was that he generally wrote his own songs. Now, it's true that many of his songs were probably reshaped by a Nashville songwriter named Fred Rose, but for the most part, they were Hank's own songs, and they came out of his personal experiences. No better example than a song called Your Cheating Heart.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss and call my name. You'll walk the floor the way I do. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
A performer who put his name indelibly on the musical map in just, what, short 29-year lifespan. Hank Williams there with one of the most famous songs of the 20th century, Your Cheatin' Heart, and very influential, too, in terms of music to come. Well, speaking of music to come, we'll have more as we follow the history of country music into later decades right after this. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Bill Malone, and we're following the history of country music as it goes through various styles in American musical taste over the 20th century. And we mentioned Hank Williams and how he really captured the imagination, influenced musicians to follow, including some of the early rock musicians. And you mentioned part of that had to do with crossover, but of course you also, in terms of their listening, but you also have to kind of work the deals, don't you, as to who actually gets to perform your song.
Yeah, Hank was a dyed-in-the-wool rural singer, I think. I think he couldn't be anything but that. But his songs crossed over. And one of the reasons why they did is because his manager, Fred Rose, with Acuff Rose Publishing House in Nashville, and Mitch Miller, Columbia's leading musical director, came to an agreement that when Hank would come up with a new song, they would make this song available to Mitch Miller, who in turn could turn them over to Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney and people like that.
With very different styles.
And sometimes it would come the other way. They would find a pop song that they thought that a country person might do. But more often, it was these songs, particularly those of Hank Williams, which were made available for pop singers to do. And Tony Bennett did have some hits with Cold, Cold Heart and There'll Be No Teardrops Tonight, to cite only two examples.
We were talking earlier about the brother acts. Like the Leuven brothers and these close harmonies. Where did the Everly brothers come out of this mix?
The Everly brothers were performing this music almost from birth. Their father was a famous guitar player from Western Kentucky named Ike Everly. And he played a style known as the Muhlenberg style. It's the same style that Merle Travis and a lot of other people played. And you know, Merle Travis, for example, who probably did most to make it famous, he played with only two fingers, thumb and first finger. And he was so adept at it, and when people heard it over the radio, they thought he must be playing with at least three or four fingers, or four fingers, I mean. They didn't realize that he'd make that syncopated sound with just two. Well, anyway, he had a band along with his wife that played all over the Midwest and Iowa and, I believe, Nebraska and down in the lower south. And their two sons, Don and Phil Everly, began singing with the group when they were just kids, 8 and 10 years old. So they started harmonizing that early. But they heard people like the Monroe Brothers and the Blue Sky Boys and the Callahan Brothers. And they eventually made an album, a very great album, I think, called Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. And they may have learned those songs from Daddy, but Daddy had learned them from these brother acts in most cases. So that's what the Everly Brothers brought to the table. They were the first so-called rock and roll group that sang with duet harmony. So that gave them a unique sound. And Don Everly's guitar style was modeled upon that of Bo Diddley.
Oh, Bo Diddley.
So when you hear Bye Bye Love, what you're going to hear first is you're going to hear a guitar riff that would borrow from Bo Diddley, and then you're going to hear them doing a song written by Felice and Boodle O'Brien, but in a style that was appealing to America's youth audience. Bye Bye Love. Thank you.
bye-bye, my love, goodbye. There goes my baby with someone new. She sure looks happy, I sure am blue. She was my baby till he stepped in. Goodbye to romance that might have been. Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry.
You get that echo chamber sound that was so popular by the time you got into the 1950s. Were the Everly Brothers as popular in the country music charts as they were in the rock charts?
For a while. But by the time I Wake Up Little Susie, they began to move in a big way into the pop charts. And so I think they never lost their country identification, and they never thought of them, never stopped thinking of themselves as being country musicians. But their style went way beyond that, and their popularity extended to Europe. I'm continuing to be surprised at how popular they were in England, particularly. People like Elvis Costello and Paul McCartney and Sir Tim Rice, the great Andrew Lloyd Webber team.
Wouldn't have thought of that combination.
Yeah, they speak with great reverence of the Everlys, because the Everly Brothers was what brought them into music in the first place. And, of course, once they learned about the Everly Brothers, then they learned about Felice and Bootaloo Brown, the people who were writing all these big songs. So, in a way, I don't think I'm exaggerating too much when I say that this helped to mark the beginning of the British invasion, because so many of these people, you will trace their interest in music back to the day they heard the Everly Brothers and of course, Roy Orbison.
Sure.
And Jerry Lee Lewis, a lot of other folks as well.
Now, with Patsy Cline, does she come out of more like the torch singer tradition, or come out of the sounds of Texas music, or even like the early...
I guess you'd say that Patsy was a little bit of everything she'd heard. She was a chart singer, but I don't think she necessarily thought of herself as being that. But like most people of her age, she was a child of the radio. She heard all kinds of styles, and either consciously or unconsciously absorbed them into her style. Personally, she thought of herself as being a country singer. She dressed like a cowgirl.
Sure.
And she strongly resisted having, move away from that image, which her managers insisted on. And she was against some of the songs, which were her biggest ones, when she first heard them. She said, oh, it just doesn't sound like the kind of stuff I want to do. But once she did them, she became not only a top country singer, but a singer whose sound was revered everywhere. You can still go in places all over America, and on the soundtrack, you'll hear a Patsy Cline song. And I'm sure it's been listened to and loved by people who don't think of themselves as country music fans. That just shows what was happening to country music. It was being absorbed into the pop mainstream and was also changing that mainstream.
Well, here's one that must have come out of many a jukebox and perhaps still does.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
I get the idea, Bill, that a lot of this country music is still dance music by the 50s.
And probably always was. I guess that was always one of the identifying marks of country music. Of course, a lot of the early songs were done square dance style or maybe step dancing. And it wasn't until the 40s that the two-step out of Texas and the waltz and really became dominant. So you can still go maybe all kinds of places in this country, but particularly in Texas, you can still go to the honky-tonks and dance halls down there, and you'll still hear the music of Ray Price and Bob Wills and Hank Williams still being played and sung, and people out shuffling on the dance floor.
Well, we're going to leave out a lot of names in this run through the history of country music, but if we're getting into the 1970s and years subsequent, there's no looking around Dolly Parton.
That's right. You know, she's made such a, as an image, she's made such a character of herself with her blonde hair and her heavily powdered, rouged face. And she's done that deliberately, I think, you know, just to make people notice her, coming out of a very poor background in East Tennessee. But and while she's an outstanding singer, I think people overlook the fact that she's also one of the best songwriters.
Lots and lots of songs are a credit.
And not only country music, but in American music in general. You know, people got a glimpse of it in the movie 9 to 5, where she did a lot of different styles. But to me, her best song, I think the one that'll live the longest, is a really earnest reflection of her early days when her mother was just trying to make do, making clothes for her out, whatever scraps were available. And one day, you know, she said she went to school and people laughed at the multicolored coat she was wearing. And her mother said, you know, just be proud that it's something that we've done, we've created ourselves. And it became her best song, Coat of Many Colors.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth. I recall a box of rags that someone gave us. And how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small. And I didn't have a coat, and it was away down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore. And then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness. And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. My coat of many colors that my mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. Although we had no money, well, I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me. So with patches on my britches.
Well, we started out, Bill, talking about country western music a little bit, but it seems that we have gone pretty far out of cowboy music, and yet it's partly through the truckers, but also occasionally comes back in, doesn't it?
The cowboy has never lost his mystique or his popularity. From almost from the day this music was born, the cowboy image was there. A fiddler from Texas named Eck Robertson, who made one of the very first hillbilly recordings in 1922, had gone to New York unsolicited to make a record, and he walked into the Victor offices wearing his cowboy suit, and I think it may be one reason why they recorded him. But Jimmy Rogers, the Blue Yodeler did a lot of cowboy songs, sometimes posed in cowboy costumes. So the appeal has always been there. And
the hats have never gone away.
That's right. And even today, when they still wear their boots and their jeans and their cowboy hats. It's true enough, there are still people like Riders in the Sky.
Sure.
Who do the old Hollywood style.
Sometimes with shtick and sometimes straight.
So, but as you said, more often than not, the cowboy image, when it is expressed about those people who lived or try to live lives outside the mainstream, cowboys and truckers and roustabouts, ramblers. And I think that's what Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings are talking about when they did that song, Mama, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys.
Cowboys ain't easy to love and they're harder to hold. They'd rather give you a song than diamonds or gold.
Lone Star belt buckles and old faded Levi's, and each night begins a new day. If you don't understand him, he don't die young. He'll probably just ride away.
Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars or drive them old trucks. Let them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. 'Cause they never stay home and they're always alone.
We could have done this entire conversation with almost a completely different set of performers, couldn't we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just think of all the ones we've left out. Cousin Minnie Pearl, who didn't sing, but did as much as anybody to make the music popular.
And the look, of course. Look. The price tag still on the hat.
My hero, Merle Haggard. We didn't play him. And just on and on, and I'm sure people listening will think of other people that just ought to have been there. You know?
Well, thanks for giving us a flavor of it anyway.
Well, you're welcome.
My guest has been Bill Malone, and hope we get to talk about country music some other time.
Okay, I would love to.
Look forward to that. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me the next time around for University of the Air.